Quiz. Listening section.
This is a quiz for the listening section of the Next Generation TOEFL. This section tests your ability to understand campus conversations and academic lectures. During the quiz, you will listen to one conversation and one lecture. You will hear each conversation or lecture one time and respond to 12 questions about them. You may take notes while you listen. You may use your notes to answer the questions. Once you begin, do not pause the audio.
Questions 1 to 4. Conversation.
Listen to a conversation on campus between a professor and a student.
Hi, Professor Taylor.
Hi, Jack.
I was hoping that I could talk with you for a few minutes. It's about the test.
Oh, okay.
Well, I've never taken an open book test, and I just don't know what to expect. Does that mean I can use my book during the test as a reference?
Exactly. And you can use your notes in the handouts, too.
Really?
Yes. But Jack, since you've never taken an open book test, I should warn you, it isn't as easy as it seems.
Because
you don't have enough time to look up every answer and still finish the test.
Oh.
That's the mistake that most students make. You see, the purpose of an open book test is to allow you to look up a detail or make a citation. But the students who are looking up every answer spend too much time on the first few questions, and then they have to leave some of the questions at the end blank.
So it's important to pace yourself.
It is. The test's 1 hour long, and there are 20 questions, so you have to be working on question 10 in half an hour.
Right. That's clear enough. So, how do I prepare for an open book test?
Well, the first thing to do is to organize your notes into subject categories, so you can refer easily to topics that might appear in the test questions. And then study your book, just like you would for any other test. Well, some people mark passages in the book with flags to make it easier to locate certain facts. But other than that, just prepare for a test like you usually do.
Right. Professor Taylor, could I ask you, why are you making this test open book? I mean, we have to study for it like always, so I hope you don't mind that I asked. I'm just curious.
I don't mind at all, Jack. I think an open book test provides an opportunity for real learning. Too many of my students used to memorize small facts for a test and then forget all about the broad concepts. I want you to study the concepts so you'll leave my class with a general perspective that you won't forget.
Wow, I can relate to that.
Most people can. But the way I see it, this is a psychology class, not a memory class.
Well, thanks for taking the time to explain everything, Dr. Taylor.
You're welcome, Jack. See you next week, then.
Okay. Have a nice weekend.
You too.
1. Why does the man go to see his professor? 2. Listen again to part of the conversation, then answer the following question.
Yes. But Jack, since you've never taken an open book test, I should warn you, it isn't as easy as it seems.
Because
you don't have enough time to look up every answer and still finish the test.
Why does the student say this?
Because...
Three. How should Jack prepare for the test? 4. Why does the professor give open book tests?
5-14. Lecture.
Listen to part of a lecture in an economics class. The professor is talking about supply-side economics.
The fundamental concept in supply-side economics is that tax cuts will spur economic growth because these tax cuts will allow entrepreneurs to invest their tax savings, thereby creating more jobs and profits, which ultimately allow the entrepreneur and the additional employees to pay more taxes, even though the rates are lower. Let's go through that again, step by step. First, taxes are lowered. Then, business owners use their tax savings to hire more workers. This increases profits, so the business owner pays more taxes at a lower rate. And in addition, the newly hired workers all pay taxes as well. So there's more income flowing into the government through taxes. Historically, in the United States, several presidents have championed tax cuts to get the economy moving. Although this top-down economic theory is more popular among Republicans, who have traditionally been aligned with business interests, in 1960, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, a Democratic president, also used tax cuts to improve economic conditions. He probably wouldn't qualify as a true supply-sider, but he did understand and capitalize on the basic concept. But it's perhaps Ronald Reagan who's most closely associated with supply-side economics, so much so that his policies in the 1980s were referred to as Reaganomics. During his term of office, Reagan cut taxes, but actually, the huge increases in spending, especially for the military budget, caused supply-siders to debate with their conservative cousins. You see, conservative and supply-side are not the same thing. Traditional conservative economists insist that tax cuts should be accompanied by fiscal responsibility, that is, spending cuts by government. But supply-side economists aren't concerned with spending. They rely on tax cuts to do the job, period. Back to the supply-side policies under Reagan. Well, the supply-siders believed that the economic growth resulting from tax cuts would be so great and the total increase in taxes so high that the United States economy would grow beyond its deficit spending. When this didn't happen, some economists distanced themselves from the label supply-side while advocating tax cuts with greater attention to spending. Even Milton Friedman, Nobel laureate and an influential member of the Chicago School of Economics, even Friedman's now pointing out that the problem is how to hold down government spending, which accounts for about half of the national income. But he still looks to tax cuts as a solution. So, a more recent problem for supply-siders, in addition to the fiscal responsibility issue, is that corporate business tends to move their investment and jobs overseas, which critics say eventually will lead to high unemployment in the United States. But Friedman insists that by moving jobs abroad, incomes and dollars are created that, sooner or later, will be used to purchase goods that are made in the United States and produce jobs in the United States. It's supply-side economics with a global perspective. In fact, conservatives and supply-siders alike argue that progress in the American economy has been made from technological changes and increased productivity, producing different goods or more goods with fewer workers. Dr. Barry Asmus cites the example of the millions of tons of copper wire that had to be produced for us to communicate by telephone across country. Now, a few satellites will do the job. Clearly, the people who were employed in the copper wire industry suffered unemployment when the change in technology occurred. Or another example, in the case of manufacturing, 30 years ago, a General Electric plant required 3,000 workers to produce one dishwasher every minute. Now, the same plant needs 300 people to produce one dishwasher every 6 seconds. So, you might focus on the fact that many workers will be without jobs making dishwashers. But what do you suppose supply-siders would say? Think this through. They'd counter with the argument that the dishwasher will be cheaper as a result of the increased productivity, so more people can buy dishwashers and still have some money left. Again, Asmus reasons that if the consumers spend money on more goods, they create jobs because workers are needed to produce the goods they buy. If they invest their money, they also create more jobs by supporting the economy. So, some people do lose jobs because of technology, productivity, and the shift of manufacturing overseas, and only 70% find better-paying jobs when they transition to another job. Yes, that's true, and it's a personally painful transition for those involved. But the argument by supply-siders and many conservatives as well is that this is temporary unemployment, and the important word here is temporary. So, the temporary unemployment occurs in the process of shifting people not just from one job to another, but from one segment of the economy to another. To use an analogy, it would be like the shift from farming to manufacturing that's occurred worldwide as better methods allowed fewer farmers to produce food and resulted in the movement of farmers from the country to the cities where they became employed in manufacturing. And now there's a shift from manufacturing to technology, which, if supply-siders and conservative economists are to be believed, will result in an even higher standard of living in the United States and globally. But of course, the success of the United States within the global economy will largely depend on a favorable balance of trade, how much we can produce in this country in the new segments of the economy, and how much we can sell abroad.
5. What is the lecture mainly about? Six. How does the professor organize the lecture? Seven. According to the lecturer, what did Kennedy and Reagan have in common? Eight. What would Milton Friedman most likely say about moving a manufacturing plant from the United States to a site abroad? Nine. According to Barry Asmus, what are two key ways that consumers contribute to the creation of new jobs? Ten. How does the professor explain the shift from manufacturing to technology? Eleven. Why does the professor mention the General Electric plant? 12. Listen again to part of the lecture, then answer the following question.
Now, the same plant needs 300 people to produce one dishwasher every 6 seconds. So, you might focus on the fact that many workers will be without jobs making dishwashers. But what do you suppose supply-siders would say? Think this through.
Why does the professor say this?
Think this through.
Thirteen. In the lecture, the professor explains supply-side economics. Indicate whether each of the following strategies supports the theory. Fourteen. Put the following events in the correct order.